From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. The rift between the United States and Israel has worsened, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel scheduled to address Congress on Tuesday. Netanyahu's appearance is opposed by President Obama, and some congressional Democrats have said they will boycott the speech. In New York, three men who aspired to join the terrorist group ISIS in Syria were arrested, and officials alleged they also had targeted President Obama, police, and Coney Island for attacks. And in northeastern Syria, hundreds of men, women, and children in one of the world's oldest Christian communities were seized by ISIS. Well, I'm going to start very simply, Tom, with this really much worsened rift between Israel and the United States. But let me start with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who was invited by House Speaker John Boehner to address Congress. Why did Benjamin Netanyahu accept? Now, the White House knew about it ahead of time, hadn't approved it, but he accepted. He had to know that the White House, and the president in particular, with whom he doesn't get along very well, would be upset.
Well, I don't think he cared, Fred, because I think this was largely a domestic political calculation on Netanyahu's part. There are elections in Israel in March. I think he thought that this would be helpful at home. Whether it is or not, we'll know in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it was motivated by the fact that, as you said, he and President Obama don't get along. To put it bluntly, I'm told they can't stand one another. And they give lip service to the notion of, not lip service to the notion of the strategic importance about the alliance between the U.S. and Israel. They obviously believe that and they understand that, but I think their personal animus towards each other gets in the way. And to me, it's somewhat amazing that there are some in this White House who, not openly, but a little too incautiously, are hoping that Netanyahu loses this election. Mm-hmm. So presuming that a more moderate Israeli government would come aboard. But I think the personal bad blood between these two heads of state, heads of government, is really incalculable, and it's gotten in the way of the relationship, I think.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that has always been a constant in the U.S.-Israeli relationship is how it can't be broken, that the president always says there's no daylight between us and Israel, that these two countries are two countries that cannot be torn apart. But apparently they can be torn apart on a personal level. From a strategic level, we see, well, you know, the United States is still providing large amounts of aid. You know, from a security perspective, Israel can still depend largely on American security guarantees. But on a personal level, there is a sense that you feel that there's a disrespect here, that Netanyahu is disrespecting the president by not going through previously established channels to say, hey, I've got this invitation, I wanted to give you a heads up, and, you know, are you okay with it? For a country that's much smaller than the United States and receives a lot of help from the United States, you'd imagine that would be par for the course.
But let me follow up on that with the White House, Tom. And it would have been par for the course. On the other hand, the White House has made a huge deal out of this. As you were suggesting, White House aides, or at least administration aides, have leaked very nasty comments about Netanyahu. The White House encouraged the Congressional Black Caucus to claim that by accepting this invitation and giving this speech, Netanyahu would be disrespecting the president, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal has declared this, at least on its editorial page. This speech is now the speech of the year. Certainly, President Obama didn't want that to happen.
No, he did not. I mean, the speech has now been magnified as a result of all of that. But I also should point out that there is a fundamental strategic component to this fight, other than the fact these two leaders don't get along, and that is they have a fundamental difference on what to do about Iran. And I think the reason why Netanyahu is going to take all the heat that he has and will take for this speech and is going to do it is because it will give him a huge audience, especially a congressional audience, to make the case that the U.S. government is minimizing the threat of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And this is, I think, a problem for the president for the obvious reason that talks between the West, notably the U.S., and Iran have been going on for a few years here, and they're reaching a flashpoint. Sooner or later, and probably sooner, these talks are either going to bear an agreement or the U.S. is going to have to walk away from these talks. And I think Netanyahu is consciously trying to turn congressional support against Iran and, by definition, against the president's policy. And the president has said, we can't do anything legislatively about Iran. We can't impose new sanctions on Iran because the talks will collapse. And so I think Obama and Netanyahu have much to gain and much to lose from this speech. But on balance, I think Netanyahu understood that it was going to cause him real problems with the U.S. government. But it was important for him to be out there talking tough on Iran a few weeks before the election.
Do you think, Tim, that it was a mistake for the White House? Not to be upset, I understand that. Your point was a good one earlier. But to make such a flap out of this.
Like, a lot of this is just about ego, right? So on a personal level.
Well, at least some of it, yeah.
At least from the White House perspective, they feel that they have been wronged on a personal level, that they didn't get to approve the dinner party invite or something like that. I mean, there are yeah. important mm-hmm. strategic points to this, mm-hmm. but a lot of the leaks are human.
Yeah,
That people feel personally aggrieved about it.
Yeah, well, they think, obviously, strong elements of the Obama administration, the president on down, really don't like Netanyahu. It's the president personally, but they don't like him politically or geopolitically or anything, Tom.
Well, I was just going to add, Fred, all three of us have been in situations where sometimes you get information a little too easily, and it was it was amazing to me, just from a talking shop standpoint here, this is not the world's most open White House. Their information release is grudging at best, and yet the day after this speech was announced, it was with lightning speed that the White House officially noted that President Obama did not plan to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu when he was here, and they blamed that on domestic politics. The press spokesman, Josh Earnest, said it would appear that President Obama would be taking sides in the Israeli election, and that was very inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Now, that may be technically true, but there was almost relish in the speed with which this information was put out.
Well, Tom, what about the agreement on the Iranian nuclear program? It sounds like most of the concessions have been made by the P5+1. It sounds like the Iranians have been the masters of the negotiations. Maybe I'm overstating it.
Well, I don't know if you are or not, but I do. I think you're right in terms of where these negotiations are. It just seems to me, not knowing anything specific, but it seems to me that these negotiations are down to whether the Iranian negotiator, the foreign minister, can persuade his religious superiors, the Ayatollah and others, to go along with this, that it's now kind of on the Iranian domestic internal political table. And you talked about it's not a treaty. Of course, many Republican senators believe it is a treaty, and that they claim that the only reason President Obama is calling it an agreement is that then he doesn't have to submit it to the Senate for ratification because whatever you call it might be in trouble if it had to be ratified by the Senate, which all treaties have to do.
I think the president's right about this. You know, there's some the president can volunteer to do it, but to send it to Congress, which he's not going to do. But I think technically, and I couldn't run through all the technical facts here, but that it's not a treaty. Anyway, Tim, it's not a treaty, but there is an effort in Congress. It's mainly Republicans, but not just Republicans, who want him to send this deal to Congress for its approval. The president has said, or at least his White House staff has said, he will veto any bill that comes to him that would require him to send it to Congress for ratification or approval. It seems to me that that's going to create somewhat of a controversy.
Well, yeah, and for now it seems that Senate Democrats are willing to go along until perhaps the end of March in order to see what kind of agreement actually gets reached. You know, there were a lot of discussions earlier this year and even now about imposing sanctions that would drop if there was a failure to get an agreement, thus increasing pressure for the Iranians to come to an agreement and for the United States to reach one. And that has been postponed. I mean, I think that Senate Democrats just were not ready to go against their president, and they were willing to give this idea of strategic rapprochement with Iran a little bit more time. I mean, the Obama administration just believes that it's not just about this nuclear deal, that there's a long-term strategic interest in being able to work with Iran on any number of things, and that this is the first domino to fall in a long series of events that could change, for example, the nature of relationships in the Middle East. You know, Iran is a big supporter of the Assad regime, for example.
In Syria.
And it's also got its hand in a lot of Iraqi militias, which are now trying to push forward and defeat ISIS. So the Obama administration does believe that if it could just get this nuclear deal behind them, it could solve all sorts of other geopolitical problems that have long been an issue. Now, whether you agree with the Obama administration on that, whether you agree that they're desperate to come to a deal so that they could get to these other problems, is another question entirely.
Tom, one final question, and it's this. You'll remember back in 2004, 2005, 2006, how much French President Jacques Chirac disagreed noisily with President Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq. And yet, or so I've read, that a level below this disagreement, French and American intelligence and national security advisors and so on got along well to keep the countries, while there's a disagreement at the top, but just to keep them as allies, to really work on that. There doesn't seem to be that going on right now between the U.S. and Israel.
No, I think the bad blood is the worst it's been in all the years that I've been here. I remember in the George H.W. Bush administration where Secretary of State Jim Baker had a congressional committee and a hearing and basically accused the Israelis of not being interested in peace. And he very famously said to the Israeli government, if you're interested in peace, call us. Here's the White House phone number, which the Israelis just went crazy about. But that, I think, was the low point up until this point. I think this is the worst. And you get the feeling that the Obama administration is not going to have anything to do with Benjamin Netanyahu if he is, in fact, reelected. So if that's the case, then that augurs even more poorly for the state of the relationship for the next 22 months.
Okay, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tim Mack of the Daily Beast and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click it on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Are you an iTunes user, Tim? You're younger than the rest of us.
You know, I have an iPod.
You do. Well, I have one. I just can't find it. Let's turn to these. Well, I used to use it when I, you know, would work out. But anyway, my question now is to turn to these three young men who were arrested in New York City. And they were seeking to go to Syria and join ISIS. They'd also, at least police say, they uncovered at least intentions by these three men to attack the president, police, Coney Island, and so on. And what this sort of touches on is ISIS leaders have sort of farmed out terrorism and say, let's have some. And we had that example in Australia where it say, look, do it on your own. You don't need to come here.
Canada as well, for example.
Yes, Canada as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the deep problems of ISIS and its propaganda victory since its beheadings of Americans last summer, is that ISIS is an ideology that doesn't require formal logistical networks or anything like that. It requires an internet connection and a willingness to listen, right? And so we've got these three guys in Brooklyn who were trying to perhaps become jihadists in the Middle East or to conduct acts of terror here in the United States. But really, these guys are kind of more like the Three Stooges. They're online. They're saying, hey, we're in the United States. We're looking to commit some acts of terror here. You know, think we can do it? I'd like to, you know, please try to assassinate the president. That's basically what they're posting online. That's how the Secret Service picked them up.
Yeah.
And these are not sophisticated people, but we've realized, I think, in the past year that terrorists don't need to be particularly sophisticated to do a lot of damage and create a lot of fear.
And they can be, as Tim was suggesting, they can be attracted and persuaded to join ISIS in some way just by going online and hearing propaganda speeches and so on.
It really is. It drives the Obama administration and all Western intelligence agencies crazy because it's really the subcontracting of terror on the local level.
That was the word I was looking for.
Subcontracting. Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine the other day was thinking about where his son should go to college, and he says, I want him to go to some small liberal arts college in the Midwest because nobody's going to strike there in Iowa or Kansas or suburban Montana. And the fact of the matter is you just don't know. The subtext of terror is a terror attack, no matter how small, how modest, still can carry a huge punch, and it makes it very difficult for governments to cope. But the good news, of course, is the Secret Service and other counterintelligence agencies were watching these guys, and they found them, and they had them. And whether or not they were just talking tough, and you can be sure their defense lawyers will say, well, they were just mouthing off. It was not for real. The good news is they were caught. They were exposed. But these things happen all the time. I mean, the recent example of three British schoolgirls who apparently have gone off to Syria because they want to commit jihad, and they are in Syria. So, I mean, it is a problem, and it's a problem we're going to be dealing with from these microphones, and governments are going to be dealing with for a long, long time.
Let's turn to these hundreds of Assyrian Christians who've been grabbed by ISIS, which is certainly scary, since many of the people that ISIS grabs, they wind up killing one way or another, burning to death or decapitating them. And this is one of the oldest. There are a couple of issues here. Let me go to the second one, which is the issue is this is one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East. Christians are being driven out of the Middle East, where historically they have lived thousands of years, and yet it hasn't become that big an issue in the United States with the media, I think around the world. Tim.
Right. Well, it is getting new life, though, now. I mean, I think there's been a lot of media attention on the kidnappings of Assyrian Christians by ISIS. I think the broader question here is the one that you were getting to a little bit earlier, which is ideology and the resilience of ISIS despite the American efforts to kind of push them back. You know, the latest estimates are that the United States have killed some 6,000 ISIS fighters. But at the same time, because the United States is essentially fighting an ideology, 4,000 fighters have flown into Iraq and Syria in about the same time frame. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a replacement rate that's very high, and that ISIS's actual fighting strength is not decreasing as dramatically as the United States might want it to or might imply it to. We talked a little bit about the four London schoolgirls who went off to Syria. There are also four from Montreal. It was announced earlier this week that four Montreal students were on their way to Syria as well. I mean, this is a ideology that I think attracts people who feel that they're left out of their own society, who want to fight against modernity, and that's the most resilient part of it.
Tom, you know, I was struck by the fact that these Christians were grabbed in northeastern Syria, you know, by ISIS. You know, that is a long way from Baghdad, where ISIS is also, 10-20 miles from Baghdad. I mean, they have control, or at least are active, in a huge area of Syria and Iraq now.
Yeah, this is not just a modest uprising in a localized area. I mean, the other thing about attacking the Assyrian Christians is this particular area of Syria is one of the world's oldest Christian communities. And the New York Times talked about some of those who were taken prisoners speak a modern version of Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so you don't often see, especially in a paper as august as the New York Times, a paragraph on the front page that called this latest attack a rampage reminiscent of Tamerlan or Genghis Khan. Mm. And also I think the video images of ISIS partisans defacing and destroying ancient Assyrian artifacts, I think, is a very galvanizing psychological moment. Whether it leads to anything remains to be seen. But the problem is, as Tim says, is that, which I think the U.S. learned in the Vietnam War, is you cannot bomb your enemies back to the Stone Age and be sure that it's going to be effective. Mm-hmm. And we will be talking at these microphones in many weeks and months ahead about how many more, or whether any American combat troops will have to be sent to these areas because it looks like the moderate Syrians, however you define them, mm-hmm. aren't going to be ready to fight for months at best.
I thought you were going to say something else when we might get to a situation where an American soldier is actually captured by ISIS and obviously threatened with decapitation or something.
A soldier or mm-hmm. or airman. I mean, mm-hmm. Clearly, an air campaign, which is basically what's going on right now, mm-hmm. is theoretically a little more antiseptic, and it's also safer for pilots. But that was not the case with the Jordanian airman who mm-hmm. was captured, and I think that would really be a real problem for the United States if U.S. soldiers and U.S. airmen mm-hmm. were somehow captured by ISIS. That would be quite a turning point.
All right, one more issue. We have several minutes left, and there is an annual conference in Washington called the Conservative Political Action Conference. And all the Republican presidential candidates come, and they get enormous attention. It's a lot of media and so on. And yet, Tim, the actual primaries and caucuses are a year away in February of 2016, much less the election of a new president in November 2016. I continue to wonder why there are so many candidates running on the Republican side anyway, and they're getting so much attention. There seems, my own view is, there are a lot better stories for the media to be covering than that one. It's so early.
Well, you know, I mean, there are actually not really technically any candidates for the presidential campaign. None of them have announced that they're running, although there are a lot of proto-campaigns and suggestions that they will.
I'll say there are a lot of them, yeah, but it's still early.
Yes.
And I'm not going to this conference, but an awful lot of people are in the media, Tom. I mean, you've covered, and you may have covered even more presidential campaigns than I have, but maybe one more. But anyway, what do you make of all this?
Well, it's just the prospective candidates crave the attention. But more to the point, the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, these are conservatives whose power has escalated in the Republican Party in recent years, and you cannot ignore them. You cannot ignore their clout in the party. And so anybody who aspires to be a Republican presidential hopeful has got to appear before this group, and we'll know in a few days or so what the party line is on who did well, who did poorly, who overachieved, who underachieved. But I agree with you, it's way too early, and anything that happens at CPAC, even if you did well or poorly, is not fatal. I mean, as you say, it's how many times have you heard me say, and you, I know you agree, overnight is a lifetime in politics.
Right.
Well, we've got a year's worth of lifetimes before the Iowa caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's early. So anything that happens to a Republican prospective hopeful mm-hmm. now, good or ill, is basically irrelevant. I mean, nothing's really going to change until people announce, until there's voting in mm-hmm. Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, the early primary and caucus states. We're a long way away.
The other thing is what they do may be irrelevant, but it's also not predictive. In other words, there'll be a straw poll and somebody will come in first, and that person is in no way assured or even aided, I think, in winning the Republican presidential nomination next year. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.